Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, a Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the sensational Sam G, the captivating Carla Everson, and the gregarious Greg Gordon. Today we've got myself, Ange, along with JT and Walt, and we are going to have them talk to me about what OSR games are. Before we dive into that main topic, though, we're going to ask a get-to-know-a-gnome question. And today, well, I'm pretty sure that we all got started with D&D, so I want to know what was the first non-D&D game you remember playing. JT, I'm going to start with you.
All right. So at my friendly local game store where I played D&D, they had two rooms for games, and I would weekly leave my D&D game. Actually, it was as I was arriving for my D&D game, another group was packing up and leaving and all that. And I kept showing up a little earlier and a little earlier and a little earlier. And finally was watching the game they were playing. And they're playing this really cool superhero game that I had no clue what it was. And I buddied up with the GM's name's Buddy, was Buddy. So I buddied up to Buddy and managed to cajole my way into a empty slot in their Champions game. And I had no idea what Champions was. I just knew they were playing some cool superhero looking things. Buddy was like, sure, come on in and join us. You know where and when and all that. So next week on Saturday, show up for your D&D game. We'll get you rolling. Well, in the intervening week, they had some people that leave town, go on vacation, something like that. So they didn't have a full table for their Champions game. Instead, Buddy did a one-shot of Paranoia. So my very first exposure to something not D&D as a player was Paranoia, which is vastly different in genre, style, theme, all that. But Buddy did a great job of running, you know, the setting, the computer, the conspiracy, the funny bits, you know, capturing the weirdness of cooperative backstabbing. It was just, I had so much fun with that. And I was lucky enough to be in a handful of other Paranoia games with Buddy as well. But the following week, I showed up and Buddy created a character for me. And he was like, pick a comic book guy. Not Superman, not Batman, not one of the big ones, but like a mid-range power level superhero from a comic book, and I'll make it for you. And I was like, cool. And I happened to be reading the Silver Surfer at that time, so that's who I picked. And he made Silver Surfer for me, and we ran with it.
I just have to pause you.
Okay, sure.
There is in no world that Silver Surfer is a mid-range level powered hero. I mean, maybe as far as like popularity?
Sure,
but...
sure. I don't know enough about comics to be honest with you. He just basically said, don't pick like a god level person. And maybe Silver Surfer is one of those. I don't know enough about comics to really know, did I pick a badass character or not? But, you know, I had fun playing Silver Surfer, and the bad guys loved stealing my surfboard from me because it was the obvious accessible focus, you know, for my flight. But I had fun.
Sorry to derail that there.
It's all good. It's all good.
What about you, Walt? What was your first not D&D experience?
That was like 40 years ago. I think I've forgotten more games than I've played. But what I do remember, if I go back into the Wayback Machine in the dark recesses of my brain, it wasn't too long after I got into D&D and AD&D that I started buying up, you know, any game I could get my hands on. They were primarily TSR games, and like Boot Hill and Star Frontiers and Gamma World. And I remember most of all the fact that it didn't bother me at the time, but it seems a little weird now that TSR didn't have like a house system. Every game had its own rules. And the first game that I remember playing was Star Frontiers outside of D&D. And we had a lot of fun with it, with neat alien races and stuff that were very different than what we were used to playing with our elves and dwarves and stuff. We ran through a whole campaign of, I think it was the Volturnus series, and it never dawned on me that for being a science fiction game, there were no real rules for spaceships. We basically played it just like it was like D&D with laser guns. We were on a planet running around, basically hex crawling this world, and interacting with aliens and stuff, but it wasn't very different than what I was used to. It wasn't until, you know, later they came out with Nighthawks and we started playing like Traveller and other games that, you know, I realized that. But I do remember that was probably the earliest game I remember playing. Outside of that, it was probably either Champions or Villains and Vigilantes or maybe Gamma World.
I think the concept of a house system didn't really start getting much traction until the 90s with World of Darkness. Maybe a little bit earlier with GURPS and the hero system for Champions and sure. Hero Fantasy, but...
The first one I remember really doing a house system was Palladium, or Palladium, or however you want to pronounce it. They basically used the same rules for their fantasy Palladium game, and Heroes Unlimited, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles,
right.
And Robotech, and all that.
Yeah.
I think I blocked them out because of riffs.
Hero was another early one, obviously. And I guess if you want to count sort of RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu, they kind of adjacent.
Yeah, true.
And Chaosium attempted to for a little while there with Super World and Magic World. And I digress badly.
I think for me, the first non-D&D game I was really exposed to was Shadowrun. But I have to clarify, I didn't play Shadowrun. We just had the books because they had the cool Larry Elmore cover and we'd make characters, but my GM was very entrenched in D&D and wasn't comfortable running it, so I didn't really play anything that wasn't D&D until I got to college and ended up with a new group of gamers and we started playing Champions. So we kind of all have that connection there.
Yeah.
But Champions was the first time I played something that was definitely not D&D.
Fun fact about Shadowrun that's related to what I just said about Star Frontiers. Really cool looking. Couldn't wait to play in this cyberpunk fantasy world. The first adventure we went through was DNA DOA. And we're running through this laboratory and I'm going, this feels like a dungeon crawl. And DNA DOA was written by Dave Arnson. So.
Oh, there you go.
That's funny.
Guess that makes sense.
So let's dive into our main topic. This is going to be Walt and JT talking to me about what the OSR is all about. Now, you may ask, what is the OSR? Well, depending upon who answers the question, it can stand for Old School Renaissance or Old School Revival or some variation on those. In short, it's a style of game that tries to capture the feel of games from when all of us grognards got started. I'm going to state up front that OSR really isn't my jam. But I know from talking to both JT and Walt that they enjoy it quite a bit. So let's all learn together. So, JT and Walt, what is your definition of OSR? JT, I'll start with you.
All right, I tend to lean towards the old school Renaissance phrasing for the acronym, but as I was thinking about our talking points for this specific podcast just a little bit ago, a phrase fell out of my brain of old school revision. What I mean by that is we can keep the old school feel of the gameplay. However, we need to revise out of the old school books and into the new books, even if they have an old school feel, revise out the problematic social, cultural, religious, racial issues that, you know, that exist in the older texts. So that's, I might actually start trying to champion old school revision, because revision is how everybody here knows I'm an author. My first draft is not good. But I revise it so that I can make it good before the public sees it. And I feel that we could really take the old school feel of play of, you know, capturing the open flow of game style and revise out those issues of the past.
What about you, Walt? What would you say is your definition of OSR?
Well, the funny thing, to give it a little bit of context first, when OSR started coming around, which I guess was in the mid-2000s, mid-aughts or what have you, I never understood the appeal of why do we want to go back to what I always had felt up to that point was arguably a worse version of the rules. Part of that was because I never, even though I started playing in 81, 82, we never really played it the way that, you know, most people today would say that they thought those old school games were supposed to be played. We would make our characters, or we'd have our characters. Somebody would rip open some plastic of an adventure. What does that adventure want us to do? That's what we do. And then we move on to the next, you know, the next one. So for me, OSR, to also to use another R word for myself, it's kind of sort of the old school revelation, because I've finally started to understand what Gygax and Arnson and all those other people were talking about with these strange, weird terms that I never quite understood back in the past. Like, for example, when you pick up an old D&D book and it says, or a D&D box set, and it's like, for 20 to 40 players. And you're like, how the heck do you do that? You know? Or, and even the regular modules are like 6 to 8 players. And I'm like, we were lucky to get 3 people in my basement back in the day to play something. You know, I couldn't imagine having, you know, 10 or 20, but I have discovered that for me, it's playing Dungeons and Dragons as an adventure game as opposed to a role-playing game.
I know in you know, with Jared, we've been doing the Thacko with Advantage podcast focused on D&D, and as a result, we touch on stuff from 1st and 2nd edition, even if we're mostly focused on 5th edition. And 1st edition is kind of bad with how the rules are written and stuff is in various locations and all of that. So, like, with what you guys are saying about following the rules from those old editions, it was kind of hard to follow the rules based on the original books and the way they were written.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, there were many pathways through the rule set to get to different destinations. And it was actually kind of one of the things I like and one of the things I dislike. It's like a love-hate relationship with the rules as presented in your older books, because there's an openness to the rule set that allows for freedom of creativity in actions, because not everything is proscribed on how to do it or inhibited from being done through the expression of the rules. But that leaves ample room for rules adjudications on everything a character can do. So that leads to the antagonistic GM problem that was prevalent in the 80s and into the 90s, mm-hmm. and all that, because the GM could, by fiat, decide, no, you can't do that, or no, that doesn't work that way, or, you know, yes, you must make the saving throw because I said so, and there were no rules to refute the GM fiat. Moving from table to table, GM to GM, you got vastly different game experiences.
Yeah, every group had their own. I mean, I never joined a group back in the 80s or 90s and not asked when I first walked in, what are the house rules?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Same.
We all had them. They were all the same. And depending on, like, in my geographic area with cross-pollination, there were certain house rules that it seemed like everybody in, you know, in my area were using, and there were some others that were, you know, a little different or on the same level. It's funny because I don't think I've ever actually played Advanced Dungeons and Dragons 1st edition. I think I played Dungeons and Dragons Basic, and we just used the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons as like expansions for it.
Okay.
Because if I go back and I look at how we handled initiative, how we handled combat and everything, we were really still playing it like we were playing the basic version. It's just now we're reusing all the classes out of Player's Handbook and all the monsters out of the Monster Manual, but we never tried to really play the game the way it was. I mean, play Advanced Dungeons & Dragons the way it was set up. So, but a lot of the modern retro clones and stuff clean up the rules a lot and make it a lot easier to read.
I know, historically speaking, one of the reasons Gygax started trying to clean up the rules a little bit in the early 80s is kind of the beginning of tournament play, which was a very big thing back in the 80s and 90s at conventions. And you couldn't really have these wide open rules interpreted for everybody at a tournament when people are going to be playing with different GMs throughout different games and all of that.
Well, I think that was one of the weird things about TSR, because they create this game to be played a certain way, but the published material for helping game masters that came out were primarily based on those tournament modules, which by definition are more programmed for players to just go through this.
Yes. Yeah.
The idea of Castle Greyhawk was always somewhere in the wilderness of mythology until TSR finally put a few of those out. But by that point, we were all playing Dragonlance and nobody was looking at it. I guess Keep on the Borderlands is almost there.
Yeah.
As far as that style goes, but that's about it.
So let's talk about some game systems that qualify as OSR. Well, what are some games you would say kind of land in that OSR category?
You know, there's two ways to look at it. I mean, most people try to say, you know, it's anything from like sort of the 70s and 80s. But I think if you say OSR today, most people will think it's some version of TSR era D&D or AD&D. Lately, what they call BX or the Moldvay basic Cook Marsh expert set gets most of the love. You have Labyrinth Lord, Basic Fantasy, Lamentations of the Flame Princess, and Old School Essentials are the big ones. For AD&D, you've got Osric and a couple others that are escaping me right now. And then Shadow Dark, which just came out a few months ago, that's kind of a, you know, it's a new school game, but tries to put it back in the old school rules. But unfortunately, I haven't, you know, it's on my shelf, but I haven't really broken through it because I started my group last year, and the last thing I'm going to do is try to transition them over.
Fair, so. Fair.
I think we've all got those games sitting on the shelves calling to us.
If you're talking about any games from the past, I mean, Call of Cthulhu counts, and that's still running.
Oh, yeah.
So, oh, yeah.
RuneQuest and Palladium do too. But, I mean, most people, if you say OSR, they're going to expect to sit down and play like Swords and Wizardry, which is a clone of the original books from the 70s, or, you know, one of those BX versions or Osric or something like that.
JT, what are some non-D&D style OSR games you'd put on that list?
Traveller for sure. Although Traveller, in my opinion, was a few years ahead of D&D in maturity, even though it came out shortly after first edition D&D did. Just the presentation of the rules, the put together of the book, the organization of the book, it was more well thought out than what TSR was doing at that time. And since Wizards has taken over D&D, things have kind of flipped, because they started using the Magic the Gathering template warding model, which really, really, really cleaned up things a whole lot for third edition D&D moving forward. But Traveller for a long time was a more accessible game. If you were to sit down and say, we're playing a role-playing game and I want to go easy for the players to learn, way back in the day, Traveller was kind of it over Hero and GURPS and D&D and Palladium system and things of that nature, just because it was so well organized. Now, it had the unfortunate downside that your character could die during character creation, but honestly, you had kind of had to push your luck. That was not a, oh, I rolled a 2 on this D6, so my character dies. No. It's jokingly tongue-in-cheek that your character can die during character creation, but you got to push your luck for that to happen. But I'd also throw in Gamma World, the old Top Secret and Top Secret SI. Those are, you know, OSR era games. So, yeah, I would throw those in there as well for the non-fantasy.
One of my personal favorites, James Bond 007.
I've never had a chance to get that to the table. I have a couple of the books that I used as source material for my Top Secret SI game, but I never used it direct.
Yeah, right before COVID hit, I just happened to be, I guess, on eBay at the right time. And I don't know if somebody passed away or not, but I got, like, the whole lot of the original James Bond 007 games for a pretty decent price.
Wow.
And then when COVID hit, one of my couple that we're friends with who liked to role play, they said, hey, can we play something over online while we're all stuck in the house? And I was like, well, I've got these old James Bond games. So we played through a lot of those adventures during COVID.
Cool.
That's cool.
You want to talk about a game that was ahead of its time? That one was ahead of its time. Had rules for social interaction and stuff like that.
Yeah, that is ahead of its time. So what is it about this style of game that appeals to you guys? JT, I'll start with you.
I've kind of already said my piece on this with the like dislike because of the openness of being able to create. It's just freedom of expression because the rules aren't there. They're there to guide you through the experience, but not tell you how to have the experience. And I still bring that freedom of creation into even modern games when I'm running like a Pathfinder or your third edition D&D or any modern iteration of D&D, where one of my key questions to my players when they declare an action, I will ask them, what is your intent? What is your desired outcome of attempting to do XYZ, you know, action? And then we will make a ruling, not a rule, but a ruling on the fly to see, well, are you successful or not? Or what level of success do you have? Things of that nature. So I still bring in that openness of creativity from older games into the more rigid frameworks of modern games.
What about you, Walt?
Well, my story starts with my oldest daughter, you know, not last November, but November before. We were watching a YouTube video from Matt Colville about why does D&D have such an extensive equipment list. And when he was going through how they used to play, she thought it was really sounded cool. And I said, all right, you want to get something together? And so I asked some of my old buddies, and you know, we still game on Fridays and D&D 5e, and they were all for it. So next thing I knew, I had, on any given day, 8 to 10 players coming over my house. So what I said to them was, we're going to play this differently. It's not going to be like our, you know, I said, it's an adventure game, not a role-playing game. So I yanked out the outdoor survival map, which is actually considered a something you should have if you got the old white box D&D, along with your copy of Chainmail, I guess. But I was running it with, you know, old school essentials, the BX version of the game. Plopped down my Keep on the Borderlands, threw a few more locations on there, and basically what I really love about it is it's got a very beer and pretzels feel. Like, I told them when we start, you know, the game starts with you in a safe place, probably, you know, the inn at the keep, or if we decided to stop somewhere else or start somewhere else. And then whatever you go on adventuring that day, and our sessions tend to last about 6 or 7 hours. You come back at the end of the day to a safe place again. We tally up the XP. You divide up, you know, your treasure and, you know, magic items or whatever, and then we call it a day. So I don't have a missing player problem in that campaign because whoever shows up that day goes on the adventure. Whoever didn't show up, their character stayed back at the keep or whatever. You know, we don't have, oh, you know, we were just about to get into this big fight and now two players couldn't make it tonight. So that's a lot of fun and a lot of worry off my head. Our group also, like I said, very heavy on the nostalgia. We throw in a lot of 80s references when we play. I had them find a monolith and they were trying to figure out the code. They had a code, and so they were typing it in, and I just got 86 out of my mouth, and my daughter looks at me and goes, are the next numbers 75309? or the fact that the evil reptile cult in the game uses a red cobra head as their symbol and stuff like that. The game is also very low prep because since I have the adventure locations out, and now we've got tons of material that I can throw down, and my kids who play with me and their friends, they have no idea what this stuff is. So it self-regulates. I don't have to really worry about levels and stuff too much. And there's probably the most important thing, I think, is that there's not a lot of sheet play. One of the issues that, you know, I see a lot in modern D&D, not so much other modern games, because other games tend to be more rules light, but especially in D&D, people tend to play their sheets more.
Right.
You know, you have a lot of interesting stuff on your character sheet. You want to use it. And in the old school games, you don't have a lot on your sheet. You're supposed to, you know, it's actually what you brought as equipment is more important than what your character abilities are most of the time. And so the players need each other to survive. So there's a lot more party unity in how you go. And your characters end up getting, you know, if you want to get more powerful, you're getting magic items. And the nice thing about in the old school is, all those new abilities you get from magic items come with stories on how you acquired them. You know, you don't go to a shop and pick up a sword plus two, you know, flame blade or whatever. You had to go find it in that volcano over there. You don't have players showing up with new powers going, because I just leveled up.
Right.
So that part of it, I really find, you know, very refreshing. I'm about to launch a 5e game in a couple weeks, so it's not like I've given up on the new school too, but they both run very differently and they both scratch different issues.
JT, what about your most recent campaign that you've run that's OSR styled?
I'm actually currently a player in a Osric game, which is the old school reference index compendium is what Osric stands for, something like that. But it's basically a revision of first edition AD&D with all the tables changed, because apparently the tables were somehow copyrighted, but the rewriting the text is not. So it's not a one-to-one conversion, but we're having a blast with it. We're actually running through our Game Master, Kevin, is running Ardenvale, which is a first edition AD&D mega dungeon. And oh my God, is it a mega dungeon. 10 levels and like 15 sub-levels, and there's above ground stuff and multiple cities to visit and interact with and all that. We've been playing this over 2 years now, and Kevin estimates that we have seen about 30% of the material in the books. So, but we're having a hoot. It's just, you know, like Walt said, that there's not a lot of sheet play. You know, when you get in a tight spot, new players or newer systems kind of lean you into staring at your character sheet to figure out how to get out of the tight spot. The old school play is think your way out of it. What, you know, yeah, look at your character sheet, make sure you don't have an obvious answer, but you know, once you're done with that quick skim of your sheet, you got to think your way out of the box to figure out how to either move forward or escape alive. So that's where I'm at with my current OSR games.
These are games based on older games that we used to play, but what are some modern sensibilities of game design that have made it into your OSR games? Well, I'll toss this question to you first.
Ooh, goody. The one that I'm like, I don't know. No. For me, my old school game runs a lot more like most of my more modern games that aren't D&D, because a lot of them, you know, we have, you know, I'll set the players up in a sort of a social situation where there's other contacts and NPCs that they're interested in stuff. And so there's a lot of free form, a lot of letting the players breathe, you know, their characters breathe a little bit. And you definitely get a lot more of that, you know, with old school play as well. Because, you know, again, you don't have a sheet that, you know, is you're trying to reference, you know, constantly. Some other modern sensibilities I bring into my OSR games is I allow a lot more customization and character generation. I realize that while it is fun to do the whole 3d6 in order thing, and we did try that out in the first session that we played, modern players want a bit more, you know, uniformity, or, you know, you have characters running off of cliffs until they can roll again. So I do have, you know, a bit more customization there. I also allow new characters. They do come in low at lower level, but they don't start at ground zero. And I actually have an accelerated track for players so they can catch up to where, you know, the top line is, because it's no fun hanging around behind your, mm-hmm. you know, fifth level friends all the time when you're stuck with a first level character. I also do, yeah, secrets that I don't want my other players listening to this, you know, here, but I do keep challenges.
Yeah, you can keep your secrets. Yeah,
I do keep challenges roughly in check with my, you know, with what their levels are and stuff. I don't, you know, plaster them with, you know, they're not going through the G Giant series at level 3 or anything like that. But, and if they do find something that's, you know, sometimes when you roll in a random encounter and it's like, well, here comes the red dragon, 40 years later, the players are savvy enough to know that their second-level characters should probably run and hide rather than try to deal with the thing. We only use the law versus law of neutral and chaos axis. We don't have the good and evil axis in my games. And it's the way my world is set up, there was a huge, you know, what they call the Wizard War, which left a lot of ruins everywhere, which are now dungeons and mega dungeons. And the creatures that are inhabiting those are, you know, sort of naturally against civilization where the players are coming from. So a lot of times they're not just, you know, they're waking up. They're not just waking up at the tavern in the morning going, you know, whose house do we want to raid today? They are doing good while they're doing, you know, what they're doing. You know, one thing I did notice is kind of weird in BX, or, you know, the type of the D&D that I'm playing, which is Moldvay, and I guess you could say the Beckamy version of the rules do it too, is that that version of the rules didn't have the different charts for male and female characters. And as much as people laughed at race as class, you didn't get stat bumps for being a different, you know, species than human. So these things that we kind of look at now as outdated were never in that version of the rules.
Right.
Back in the day. So it's kind of a weird, you know, kind of a weird thing. Irony, I guess. But
what about you, JT? What are some modern sensibilities that make it into your games?
Like Walt, we do not do the 3d6 straight down in a row. We actually do, because we want you to be the big damn hero, right? We want you to be more robust than average peasant person. So we do 4d6, drop the lowest die, so you end up with 3d6 for a stat, but you get to throw away one of them. And if you're running without comeliness, so you have six stats, you get to roll seven numbers and pick six of those seven to apply to your character. So it ups the curve of power a little more, but that's the style of play that we want to experience within our group. That's one of the key mechanical changes that we make outside the rules as written for OSR games. And, you know, more, we also apply more modern social morals to our game the vast majority of the time. We don't approach the game with all orcs are evil or all drow are vile or anything like that. We're high enough level so that we view orcs as cannon fodder. We still view drow as, oh my god, they're scary, but we're not going to go slaughter them all just because they're quote-unquote an evil race. We don't do that anymore, except for halflings, but they've earned our hatred. at least for this campaign. The halflings have been like cockroaches in our domains. We're high enough level that we have like our own temples, our own inn, a wizard's tower, yada, yada, yada. And these halflings keep showing up and messing up the works. It's like cockroaches. Once they're in the walls, you can't get rid of them. So we have a very powerful enmity towards halflings. We don't consider them evil. They're just highly annoying, and we want them to go away.
So what would you guys say to someone like me who moved on from the olden days of gaming with essentially some bad memories of the old style? When I heard about this is a style of games, I was like, why in the world would I ever want to play a game like that again? JT, I'll toss it to you first.
First off, I'm sorry you went through that. and yes, I did as well. I probably got the t-shirt to prove it. Got it in the gift shop that I bought from the crappy GM store, right? You know, the old style of play was horrendous to many people, me included. But we've evolved our gaming styles and approaches and maturity levels to the point where we don't want to play with those kinds of people anymore, so we uninvite them from the group. That opens up safety, and I'm not necessarily talking safety tools, but like a safer environment, a comfortable environment, a welcoming, warm environment where you could whip out the old white box set or the first edition books or Beckmy or anything from way, way, way back in the day and play those, you know, older systems, but in a safer environment. So I think that's where things have changed quite a bit. And we also have things like on the internet, like Gnome Stew, that gives advice on how to be a good game master. A lot of that didn't exist in, you know, 70s, 80s time frame.
No.
And I'm not talking about the internet in general, but just the ability to find GM advice. some books did have how to run the game, and some of those books even advised the game master to be wary and suspicious of player creativity because that means they're up to something and they're going to do bad things to your game. So there was very poor advice published way back in the day, and not a lot of good game master advice published way back in the day. But things have changed, so here we are.
Yeah. What about you, Walt? What would you say to me?
Well, just to jump off of JT for a bit there, a lot of the confusion would have been gone if we had YouTube back in the 70s, where Gary and Dave could have gotten online and showed us all how we were supposed to play this thing.
Right?
Oh, but their feud would have been so much more public.
Yeah, it would have been fun. I just want to read the comments. I
Yeah.
mean, obviously, if I had somebody like you, Andrew, who walked up and said, "Hey, I want to, give this a try," but I had bad memories, I'd want to know what those memories are so that, I could at least assuage your fears that that's not how we play.
Gatekeeping and TPKs. So many TPKs.
Well, we don't gatekeep, I can tell you that much. I have a very diverse group in, of all genders, orientations, and ages. Everybody's at my table. So it's very, safe and welcoming and, all that. It's also very, like I said, very beers and pretzelsies. I mean, you could literally call me up and say, "Hey, I'm in the area. I know you're running a game today. Can I join?" And it's not a problem.
Nice.
I could, I could have your character, help you roll it up in like 5 minutes. You're in there and you're just along with everybody else. You're introduced at the same time. You go off on an adventure, you come back, you've had a full experience. You have a full experience because you and the group decide amongst yourselves what it is you're going to be doing that day. Even though I have different things out there and there's different things to play with, and you get rumors that, maybe tease you in a certain direction or not, and I'm not above throwing in a colorful NPC or two to help things along when necessary. But it's a very relaxed atmosphere. You don't take it too seriously. If you happen to lose a character, which it happens in my game, but not nearly as much as I think those tournaments and adventures they published back in the day were far deadlier than anybody was ever really playing. It's just a fun time, and there's and it's a very easy, you don't have a big obligation either. If you can make it this month or this session, but you can't make it next session, it's fine. There's no issues. It doesn't muck up anybody's adventure path or anything like that. It really is something that I think everybody, should try once or twice because it gives you a completely different perspectives on things. I can say that, as I said before, I'm about to start up another 5e campaign, and I do far more work to try to keep four or five people around the table entertained than I do for my group of 10. So it's, that game, I literally could, don't tell my players this, but completely not think about it until an hour before that game, and I'm still good to go.
Neat.
Any last words you guys would like to say about OSR before we start heading out of here? JT?
Yeah, think about the roots of the game, like of role playing in general, right? Specifically D&D, it came out of Chainmail, which was a tabletop wargaming simulator game, right? And the creators of D&D, specifically Gygax and Arneson, had more experience with tabletop wargaming than they did with their own creation, at least initially. So they were coming to the table with the ingrained perspective that the other person with dice was the enemy, not a collaborator. And I think it took them a while to outgrow that ingrained perspective. And it may not have been a conscious, perspective or conscious thought that, oh, they have dice, therefore they're my opposition. It just was part of their gaming lifestyle. And we have since moved away from that. And I hope we continue to distance ourselves from the other people with dice or bad guys or the opponent, right? And I suspect that both Gygax and Arneson moved away from that perspective as well over time. So when you look at the very early materials published, take it with a grain of salt, like take it with the lens of its day. However, you don't have to accept everything that was put in those books, and a lot of stuff we should openly reject, you know, like the misogyny, the racism, the other bad things, right? That needs to be openly rejected and removed, which is why I like my new phrase that popped in my head as I was thinking about this episode of the old school revision. We can revise out all that problematic material, but keep the good stuff around.
Any last words from you, Walt?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that for me and for my group and for my friends, and I would hope, you know, for anybody, it's a lot easier to think of OSR or old school games or whatever as their own thing to be enjoyed alongside modern games. It's not a competition. And, you know, I get very different, you know, good vibes from one set of rules than with the other. You know, I do not participate in edition wars. I do not believe in them. If you want to play games where your characters are heroes and you're going on a quest and, you know, a more directed, targeted type of game, more modern games are probably your jam. If you want to have more of a sort of a party atmosphere with a large group and, you know, enjoy an afternoon of crawling through dungeons and meeting strange new things and trying to get out of there alive, you know, OSR's got your back. You know, it's just, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's something, again, that I think that everybody should try at least once, because, you know, if you're looking at it like me, like, you know, why do I just want to play the same way with older rules? What, we're not playing the same way. It's a different experience. I guess before I start talking around in circles, I'm just going to leave it there.
This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, so our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show for you to check out.
Daiko with Advantage. Ange and Jared love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together, they share insights into the games they're running in the campaign journal, and then tackle a variety of topics that affect the game in the DM's workshop. They're going to talk anyway, so they may as well record it. Maybe you'll even pick up an ancient D&D factoid about a previous edition of the game, hey, OSR stuff, that you'll never use.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with Gnome Stew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to today? JT, go.
All right, I'm going to be a little self-serving in this moment and ask people to head over to my Amazon Author Central page. We'll have a link in the show notes. I just released 7 short stories that were previously published in anthologies, but now you can get the stories just by themselves. They're available in ebook and print. And since they're, you know, bite-sized short stories, they're not that expensive. We're talking like, you know, $5 for the print version or $1 for the ebook. It's pretty easy to get to amazon.com/author/JT Evans. There's no punctuation, no capitalization. It's all smushed together. So again, amazon.com/author/JT Evans. And if you're driving, don't try to write that down. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Well, anything you want to give a shout out to today?
Yeah, sure. Accepting the things that I'm still NDA'd on. Staying on topic, Cubicle 7 has, you know, released a few months. I guess it's been a few months, but Uncharted Journeys, which is basically sprucing up the adventuring part of adventuring. So, you know, when you're getting from point A to point B, making that, you know, really interesting, which is also something that's huge in the OSR. You know, the traveling is part of the adventure.
Oh yeah.
They also have coming out soon a Life Well Lived, which covers downtime and another fun thing with the OSR home bases. Again, both those books are for 5e, and if you had been following their Adventures in Middle Earth when they had that, you know, their adaptations from that material. Also, if you like chocolate and your peanut butter together, another project that I had a lot of fun writing was Doctors and Daleks, which just came out, which is basically the 5e version of the Doctor Who role-playing game. And I just saw that, you know, Renegade posted pre-orders and previews for upcoming projects that I was a part of. That was a lot of fun. Beneath the Helmet for Power Rangers. Story of the Seasons for My Little Pony. And the Quartermaster's Guide to Gear for G.I. Joe. So There's a lot of my 80s nostalgia right there, and 90s nostalgia.
Nice. So. We will try and have links for all of those in the show notes. For me, by the time this episode drops, Origins 2024 Event Reg should be live. Origins is going to be happening in Columbus, Ohio during June from Wednesday the 19th through Sunday the 23rd. It's definitely a bigger con, but not nearly as overwhelming as Gen Con, and it is one of my favorite cons to attend, so I just wanted to give it a shout out, and maybe I'll see you there. So, do you guys think, we're seasoned enough to go into the stew this week, or should we avoid it because we need a little more old school experience?
Oh, I'm an old tough meat kind of guy, so I don't know if you want me in the stew.
I'm the crusty loaf of bread that you stick in the side there.